Danny is one of the leading researchers in Britain. I think I can probably say the leading researcher in Britain, who has tackled the question of inequality and social deprivation, and has produced a whole series of publications, including a number of very important books, which give us ways of understanding through maps and graphs and other means of mobilising data, understanding some of the critical issues in terms of inequality in British society. So this is his latest book, and the cards have gone round, and Danny explains that this is actually a proper postcard, so that you can send to your family and friends. And it advertises this book, which came out in June through Polity Press. If it's anything like the quality of, and I'm sure it is, of Danny's other publications, it'll be well worth a read. We'll show you later on, we'll direct you to Danny's website, so you'll be able to learn more about his publications. So I'll pass over to Danny, and after he's spoken, there'll be ample time for discussion. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the invite. I'm only going to speak for half an hour. That's the good news. So we should have half an hour for our questions. The bad news is I'm going to go all around the houses, because there are lots of different things we could talk about. I'm interested in inequality and what's happening with that. I'm going to talk a bit about housing, the problem of getting housing, a little bit about health and the health crisis at the moment. And I'm going to stick a bit about Brexit in. Why not? So I will definitely upset somebody. Whenever I go somewhere, I've not been here before, I've been down here to the beach because this is where geographers go and measure things. I've not been here. Whenever I go somewhere, I draw one of these maps. These are publicly available and they're quite interesting. It's simply a map of the government's deprivation index. And this is an interesting area because normally an area this kind of size would largely be one colour or a couple of colours. But you've got more colours mixed than most places, so you should be proud. You should have a sign up at the station that says, "Welcome to Weymouth, the most socially divided small urban settlement on the south coast of the country." The dark reds are in the poorest tenth of areas for probably extra states, I could get it wrong. The green is the poshest, and the dark green is the poshest of all. You can tell me later whether that's right or wrong.
It's right.
Yeah. It's right.
Yeah. Probably give me your postcode and tell me what job your dad did, and I've got you. But anyway, you can try and pretend to be whatever class you want. Just those two pieces, better than your jeans for information. Anyway, so but it's, you know, this is a divided country. This kind of thing doesn't happen in other European countries. It's very, very English to have this and to tolerate this kind of inequality. We currently are at the top of the European league table for inequality. Well, that's quite an achievement. There are about 30 odd countries that are measured by the OECD, and we're there at the top and have been for a few years. That's somebody phoning up to complain. I'm going to say, no, it's actually Latvia.
It could be somebody trying to get in.
It could be somebody trying to get in.
They're going
to
say it's really Latvia, Danny.
Tim, could you do the back door, please? Thanks.
Okay. Okay, just one slide about where I'm from. I grew up in Oxford, little southern town. I came back to Oxford 5 years ago, gentrified, much posher town. But something's happening. Something's happening in many, many ways that is different from before, different from the last 50 years. So if you have a sense, if you've got a feeling that something's happening, but you're jaded at my age, you think, oh, I've had that feeling before. Most of you will have felt, if you're normal, that when you were 18 or 19 or 20, you were living through really interesting political times. And I'm afraid you weren't. It's just something that comes from being a kind of late teenager, and the world's very important. But now, if you want to know when was important, 1913 to 1916 was really important. The mid-1970s were really important, and now might be really important in terms of times when things may be changing. If you're wondering what this is, these are ex-council houses in one of the poor parts of Oxford. And this is something which has possibly never happened in the history of that town. You know, maybe for a few months in 2008, but they hid it, but never This is a picture from the estate agent window in Cowley in Oxford, and every single property was like this, reduced from 290,000, okay, excessive for a two-bed ex-council, to 260. Bang, never happened in at least 100 years. House prices have never gone down anywhere in my home city. And in London, there are similar things going on. There are lots of things happening for the first time that haven't happened before. Now, they might all just go away. We don't know. But what we can say is that this kind of thing is new. I'm going to show you later. Don't worry about that. I'm going to show you later about life expectancy. Life expectancy is the most shocking because it really matters. Life expectancy always goes up, apart from when you have a flu pandemic in 1918-19, and apart from the first couple of years of a war and the Blitz, that actually went up towards the end of the war. And all the way since the war, the life expectancy in this country has gone up every year, never fallen. It goes up normally by about a quarter of a year, and it does the same in all other countries of the world. In fact, it's going up faster in poor countries than rich countries. It's going up the fastest at the moment in Finland, in the whole of Europe. Finland's the area which has falling homelessness. Finland has the best school exam results, and somewhere you'd have thought we'd go over and ask them, but you know we don't. Since 2014, life expectancy for both men and women has fallen in this country, and we haven't yet got back to 2014. In fact, at the start of this year, we had the biggest rise of deaths we'd ever seen. And that was despite the fact that we closed almost all our NHS hospitals for routine operations so they could all concentrate on accident and emergency in the winter. And still, we got the biggest rise in deaths we'd seen. So God knows what would have happened if we hadn't done that. Infant mortality in the last 2 years has risen significantly in this country. It's risen nowhere else in Europe. If it wasn't for Brexit, this would be dominating the news.
Yeah.
It's amazing what isn't. What happens when it gets reported? The BBC More or Less programme, I think to their eternal shame, report it as, oh, we think it might be because there's more premature babies. There are premature babies all over Europe. Well, it's not a special thing that means more premature babies here, but they survive more often there. And just to give you an idea, you're talking an extra one baby in 1,000 dying, okay? But that just doesn't happen elsewhere. We have an infant mortality rate that's twice that of Finland. Finland is hardly the land of milk and honey and cash. 2 weeks ago on Thursday in Oxfordshire, it was suddenly announced by the BBC that five of the six maternity units were going to close on Thursday night, or had closed. All home births were cancelled. All the midwives were being moved to the central hospital, and you had to get there if you're going to have a baby. And if you're in Chipping Norton, and the important thing about Chipping Norton, if you remember the Chipping Norton set, you know, this is where Cameron has his shed and where Rebecca lives and all that group. If you're in Chipping Norton and you were due to give birth in a very nice maternity suite in Chipping Norton, you have to check on Facebook to see if they're open just after you go into labour. Seriously. And if they're not open, you've got to drive down the main road into the city of Oxford for miles out. So in other words, don't go into labour at 6 in the morning, because if you know Oxfordshire, the roads are awful.
Have a drink.
Have a drink. Let's top you. Yes. And then go fast on the other side. But it is, I can do anecdote after anecdote of just things. When I was born, we had the lowest infant mortality rate in the world in the UK and in Oxfordshire because we had the first baby incubators. Right. Things have changed dramatically. This graph is all about inequalities. It's too complicated and too historical, so I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to come to this one. I've got two mini graphs, as you'll see, which is why I will be ending at past and do questions. This little line here is about housing. This data was collected by Becky Tunstall, who is a professor who runs the housing unit at the University of York. And it's about how many more rooms do the best housed people have compared to the worst housed people. So it's rooms per person. Don't worry if you don't get it, it is complicated. But there's a really important message here. The important message is you don't have to build loads of houses. it would be nice to build some. Way back in 1911, the best of 10 for people had 4 times more rooms in their houses per person than the worst of. So the best of 10 might have been somebody living in a house with one room, and then the worst of 10 for families, you had 4 of you in one room. Okay, that was the kind of inequality. 1921 was worse. Then things got better and better and better ever so slowly. So the heady heights of socialist equality just before 81, where the best of had 3 times more rooms per person than the worst of. Right, but that's the best we ever got. That was the end of Cathy Come Home and all those campaigns and building council housing and allocating according to need. When you allocate according to need, you get the right size family and the right size property. And then it does this. Can you see it going right up? Mm-hmm. In 2011, we got that the best of 10 forgot 5 rooms per person. 5 times more rooms per person than the worst of 10. And that is people bumbling around on their own in a very large property, or with 2 or 3 properties, and other people being increasingly concentrated into fewer. The way it kind of works, I don't know if it happens here, you can tell me, but you know, supposing there was a council estate, I don't know, just over there. Nice free bed.
It's all there.
It's all there, okay, behind me. Right, council, but like, 3 bed semis? 3 bed semi? Okay, you do right to buy. Then you sell it on to a landlord, and that landlord then hires it out. And landlord will hire it out to whoever pays the highest rent, which could be a young professional, I don't know, working for the local newspaper, who might not want to be...
Definitely can't.
No, you're paying the rent, you couldn't do it. But the point is you end up with one person there, whereas before it would be allocated to a family with 2 kids. That's the kind of thing you've got to do to waste your housing stock. We've got more housing in terms of bedrooms and rooms per person than we've ever had. So you can solve most of the problem of housing and people not able to start a family because they can't get a house by helping people align themselves better into the property we've got. Now the question is, how would you do that? Well, the easy side is second and third and fourth homes. I mean, you don't requisition them, you just have a very special nice high tax, so that if you want the privilege of having an empty house for most of the week, you pay a hell of a lot of money to the government for that, because you could use the money. But you also do things like you look at the council tax. I don't know, down here in Poole, is it Sandbank? I forgot.
Yeah.
Right, now, I was trying to work it out for them. So you don't stop the council tax at the current top band. Mm. You keep on going up. Mm. Because if somebody can afford to pay whatever they're paying to be in one of those houses, they can afford to pay council tax Z band money. Yeah, why not? And it's not about paying for collecting the bins. It's paying to help everybody do things. At the moment in Kensington and Chelsea, you pay less in a top banded house than in Barking and Dagenham, because the council tax is half. Because the council believes in charging as least as possible. There's all kinds of things you can do, but the point of this is just to show that thing rocketed. It mainly rocketed because of growing income inequality. Some people had more money, they could buy more houses each, other people had less. But it also rocketed because the population aged. So you end up hanging around in a house for longer in your 90s, normally after he's died. A house you can't heat because it's too big for you, but you hang on in it because you can give your grandchildren a chance of a house themselves, because it's going up in value. That was one reason people in old age would stay in houses they didn't want to be in, was because they were going to maximise inheritance, and inheritance is the only chance you've had. And we get on to Brexit. This is a lot about Brexit. Now, the elderly didn't, and it was largely the elderly, age is the major thing. The elderly didn't vote Brexit in such high numbers selfishly for their own future, because they're clever enough to know they haven't got much longer of a future. They did it for their grandchildren. They thought that this will mean that your grandchildren will be able to house themselves and so on and do this. But housing's massive. And housing is solvable. And the great news is that housing is largely solvable with the stock we've got. The housing crisis isn't due to some giant flood or the Luftwaffe coming in, you know, or an earthquake. It is solvable, but it requires encouraging people to think about how you do it. If you don't know the history of income inequality in this country, just very quickly, this is what the best of 10th have. Way back a century ago, the best of 10th had half of all the income, leaving half the other 90%. So imagine you're a group of school children. This is, I think, the best way to do it. I'm not sure, but you're a group of school children, and we've got about £100 to give out in terms of pocket money a week. You, little lot in the first two rows, you're going to share 50 quid among you. So that's about 5 quid each. And the rest of you are all going to have 50 quid, so that's about 5p each. So you're getting 5p pocket money a week, and you've got 5 quid. Now, how would you lot think about these lot? Right, but that's where we were 100 years ago. That's where he made them friendly and married them. Right? The best advice I can give, which is ironic given the university I work in, where it's possible, you know, young people say, what should I do? And sometimes I do talks about the 1%. And if I do a talk about the 1% in the business school, people come up after us and say, what can I do to get in the 1%? And you explain to them, look, only 1% can be in the 1%. They go, I know, but it's going to be me. The most effective way to get into the 1% is to marry into the 1%. But that's a bit sad, isn't it, really?
A royal wedding.
A royal wedding, yes. Well, they both were, weren't they, already? He was a nightclub owner. What's that? And works for George Clooney's drinks firm? Anyway, we're again. Do you know where she went to university? My one, Newcastle. Newcastle is a special university for minor royals who find things really difficult. I can say that, being an alumni. I got the shock of my life. I went to Newcastle at 18, thinking I'd be going to a rough, tough, hard northern university because I come from the south. And I didn't like Oxford because I grew up there. Turned up it was 80% private school.
No,
nobody told you.
God.
What it was, I shouldn't diverge, but this is Britain. If you go to one of the top posh schools, you're supposed to go to Oxford or Cambridge and they all apply. Only one in three get a place, like from Eton or Rodine or whatever, Harrow. So already in this country, 2/3 of the children of the richest feel they failed at 18. It was incredible. Your second option then is Bristol, Durham, maybe Exeter. Mm. You probably get in, but you turn up, you failed. Well, my mum and dad had spent £250,000 on you in Eton. And all you had to do was get into Oxford and Cambridge, and you were at Bristol. But I do sympathy for the rich. I'm not getting much feeling from you. but do even worse, you don't get into Durham even, which would be a failure. Where do you end up? Newcastle. You know, but then, you know, somebody buys you a wedding dress that costs £150,000. That's it. That's good, isn't it? Anyway, there's the past. Very, very unequal. The equivalent of £150,000 wedding dresses. First World War was only supposed to last a few weeks. Went on for a few years. Had to tax the rich because somebody had to pay for it. Revolution in Russia. That concentrated the mind. Halford Mackinder, the bloke my... Halford, amongst other things, who was a Conservative and Unionist MP, he also, I think, helped lead the British troops to stop the revolution in Russia. Amongst the many things we don't teach in history is our attempt to stop the Russian Revolution. Yeah. Anyway, and the reason I've got the chair is some American Republicans decided to create a post at Oxford University to celebrate Halford Mackinder. And since then, it's been left-wing academics who've been appointed to it. Anyway.
Excellent.
Yeah. So thank you to the Republicans. Inequality falls and falls and falls, because if you know that you can be put against the wall and shot, it concentrates the mind. Trade unions begin to strike. The moral sentiment changes in the 1930s. We have a Second World War, at which point young people have lost all faith in the elite at all, because they got it wrong twice. And it gets better and better and better until you get to this point around about 1976, which is the most equal Britain has ever been. Ever in the history since people came across, you know, the land bridge and hunter-gathered. It's possibly even more equal than the hunter-gatherers. And that was my childhood. This was my childhood of some of you. It's quite ridiculous. There's a magical moment in the 70s where they've just made all the secondaries comprehensive. And nobody knew which was the posh one or not. You know, in Oxford, the secondary modern was up in North Oxford. And you're going, oh, do you want to go there? Because it was the secondary modern, you know. Anyway, we couldn't have that. We can't have that kind of thing. That's what they do on the mainland. We were the second most equal country in Europe to Sweden. at that point. Everybody went camping, and we won't go over it. Right? There was even a heat wave, specially put on, created by economic equality. Anyway, there was racism, there were bad things in the 70s. And there was Margaret Thatcher. Yes. Margaret Thatcher, elected leader in 70, well, not elected because they don't do elections, do they? Leader in 75, after the south of the country had voted Tory in October, down here they'd have properly voted, do you tell me? October 74, big swing to the Tories in the south. Not enough to win it, so Labour won nationally. But the Tories picked Thatcher after people in the south of England said it had enough of miners going on strike and winning in 73. And we get this huge rise. Margaret Thatcher rewarded the people who were solidly behind her. Yeah. The top 10% she gave to the most. And for her, that's the little people. You know, she was well up in the 1% by now. But the thing she got right from the point of view of being a Conservative is she rewarded her people, which was the top 10%. Then you only have to convince another two sets of 10% that they could get into that group, and that's not hard. You'd be amazed how optimistic people are. And then you've got 30% of the population with you, then you can win elections in 83 and 87, and you know, even John Major can win in 92, before people slowly begin to work out that, you know, it's only the 10% who got that. And the other two-thirds of people voting Tory didn't. And then it wobbles around at what may be a peak. But we're still in a situation where the best off 10, which includes people like me, I'm well and firmly in 10%, are taking 40% of everything, leaving 60% for the rest of the population. And that's a country that's a lot poorer. That's, if you like, that's one way of thinking about it, is that for most people in Britain, they're living in a country that's a lot poorer. This, all you need to know, is that this line is diagonal, it's blue. The blue is when over half the population have got a mortgage. In the past, this says age 56, most elderly people didn't have a mortgage. We used to be a mainly renting society. This is the 80s, this is the present. The scale's gone off the top, but it doesn't matter. That red coming back is the new renting for your whole life. So we had renting for your whole life, mainly from private landlords, and then we got housing associations, then we got council, and that comes in for this lot. And then this was the generation who were able to get a mortgage and buy, and that's where the future is currently going. That's part of a crisis. Brexit. You can tell me afterwards to not try and do diagrams this way, but I haven't done Dorset yet. This is Hampshire. The reporting of the vote is incredibly wrong. And it is shocking, this, because it's a very simple vote. You know, you've got a series of numbers of how many people voted to leave and not leave, and how many people abstained, and you should be able to work it out. The majority of the leave vote was in the south of England, because abstention rates were much higher in the north. The majority of people who voted leave were social class A, B or C1. So why are they telling you a story about working class people in Middlesbrough? The reason that they are telling you a story about working class people in Middlesbrough is because it's their parents. You're working in West London for the BBC, and your mum and dad in Hampshire voted leave. You don't quite like the fact they did that. So you tell a story about ignorant northerners and people from Stoke, not understanding economics, and Merthyr Tydfil and so on. So what I've been doing, I'm only going to show you one of these. I'm starting to make a lot of them, and it probably is a mistake, is working out for home counties, how many people voted leave. In Hampshire, 54% of everybody who voted leave. That's 546,000 leave voters. Right, Hampshire's leave central, massive, incredibly important to getting that leave majority. Nobody associates leave with Hampshire. These other areas, if you were to add up their electorates, Great Yarmouth, Derby, Leeds, big city, Sheffield, fifth biggest city in Britain, Blackpool and Merthyr, there are more people on electoral roll who could have voted in all those than Hampshire, so I'm going to call it anti-Hampshire. Okay? It's kind of equivalent area to Hampshire. More people to vote. But despite that, only 494,000 voted Leave in those areas. But you're told, oh, it's when Sheffield voted Leave, we knew it had gone. And a smaller proportion, 53.7. I could come up with more dramatic. The most dramatic home county is Essex. More people voted Leave in Essex than a collection of 22 northern districts that I can give you, which includes ones that are typically associated with Leave. And yet I can go around the home counties, and by the time I've gone round them, I've snatched up the Leave majority. I've got the whole lot. Bigger than the story. It's a home counties, Southern English, disaffected, elderly vote. Yeah. Not London, not Oxford, not Cambridge, not Bristol, but otherwise, it's places like this.
Down there in Dorset.
Yeah, and places doing better than this, Tewkesbury. It's places where people have behaved well all their lives, so I'm going to stereotype, and we're literally 7 minutes off questions, so you can... But you've behaved well all your life, you've mostly voted Conservative, you've done the right thing, you've been careful, you've saved, you haven't gone out and drunk every Saturday night, you've done what you're supposed to do, you might even have been a bit racist, you know, which kind of be nice for the bosses, and they like that. You bought your Daily Mail, you've done everything you should have done, your kids have tried hard at school, they've done a bit better, but they have to go to that comprehensive because they got rid of those grammars, and that would be lovely, because of course your child would have got into grammar, wouldn't they? Right, because people are optimistic. You've done everything you should have done. And you used to go on France on holiday, because although you're kind of middle class average, in the late 70s, 80s, particularly when your income went up a little bit, you didn't have to go camping anymore, and you could take a caravan and go to France. When you went to France, you got 10 francs to the pound. Right, and for 2 weeks, you were king, and wine cost nothing, and it was great, and Britain was great. And recently, you've been going off to Minorca, and at Gatwick, it's £1.11 for a euro. And Britain needs to be great again, because it was great once, and you're going to vote to Leave, and it's going to be great. We can go on to that in questions, I won't say any more. And it all makes sense. Oh, and everything's caused by the immigrants. The reason schools are no good is the immigrants, even especially in areas with no immigrants. I won't. No, but you've got to not take the piss, and this is why I'm not. People have been told repeatedly that the reason the schools are no good is the immigrants, the reason that your grandchildren can't get housing is the immigrants, the reason they can't get a well-paid job. It's not because 10% of people like me are taking 40% of all the income, oh no. It's those immigrants. And it's a massively effective message. It's the most salient issue at every election until the biggest economic crash since 1929. Yeah. And then it was the second most salient. You know, people go, oh, this is a terrible economic crash, we should do something about it, the economy really matters. But we still hate the immigrants. It really, really effective. There are lots of interesting things about Brexit. My view is that whatever happens, even if May cancels Article 50, it's going to be bad, whatever happens.
Yes.
Whatever happens is going to be bad. Yeah. But the kind of silver linings, well, if I showed you about inequality falling before, it's the First World War. It's much better than having a war. It sometimes takes an economic disaster and something very bad to change these curves. It's better than the war. But also, this might be what we have to do to understand that immigrants are not a problem. Already 100,000 people have not turned up from mainland Europe. You know, in my opinion, the only way we can educate ourselves that immigration is not a problem is actually by being so rude and vile and disgusting that we put people off and then we have to do things ourselves. And I say it that way because I grew up in the 70s, and although I loved them, as you can tell, I grew up in a mixed white-black family, and the NF sprayed swastikas on our wall. And they said, go back to where you came from. And it really hurt. And that's exactly how it feels like to be French or Romanian. I mean, that's a shameful thing about what's going on now. It's no difference to what it feels like for a family than what it felt like to be from the Caribbean in the 70s. Inequality or differences. This is Kensington. When you think of Kensington as very, very rich, this is again shaded by how many areas. 22 parts to the north in the most deprived quintile and so on. So very divided. And the point of me putting this up, thinking, I'll get to the point at the end why I went to Kensington. That very first picture I showed you of Weymouth, Portland. thing. A lot of the country is a lot more boring than this. But it is interesting how many places we've got when you've got these kinds of differences. London house prices are falling. They began falling in August 2016. The really interesting question is whether people from abroad will carry on buying at the top of the market. People from abroad buy at the top of the market because they think their money will be safe for their great-grandchildren. They're not buying as an investment. The pound's been falling. You don't buy a flat in London as an investment. You buy it for the very long term because you think property laws mean that your money is safe. And you do it with the first 2 or 3 million. And then with the next 2 or 3, you invest that in things you expect to get a 10 or 12% return. But imagine if it became possible that a government who might change the tax rates and put the council tax up to Z, or double it if the flat's empty. Imagine if it became possible to think that that might happen. Will these people who buy property from abroad just to invest carry on buying it? And I'll give you one hint about why that could be happening. It's current Labour Party policy that land on the edge of cities with severe housing demand will be compulsory purchased at agricultural price by the government to build housing. That's the policy. John Healey, the shadow minister, who was a Blairite, so it's not that radical, has said it's the policy. 3 of the richest colleges in Oxford are currently trying to sell their land on the edge of Oxford. Because even if you think there's only a 5% chance of a Labour government, you don't hold on to that land if you could lose it at agricultural price. Yeah? So these are signs of things happening. I need to zoom up. Homelessness figures are just terrible. You probably know, and I'd be interested again in talking to people about what actually happens here and what's hidden. Because most people who are ruthless hide themselves. So it's only a few stories. These are the figures of the numbers of children who are in B&Bs each Christmas. Every Christmas the figure goes up. Last week's statistic is 449 homeless people died in the last 12 months. That is 8 times the rate for the last few years. There is a disaster occurring in lots of ways at the moment. The main reason that people become statutory homeless, that line up there, is the end of a private sector tenancy. People can't pay the rent. The tenancy has ended and they're homeless. And that line, zooming up from 2010 to 2016, is showing the rise. This is the proportion of families who are private renting, families with kids in England. It used to be almost nothing. This was people mainly temporarily moving between houses they're getting a mortgage for. This was not planned, 2008, 9, 10, 11. 2008, the mortgage market collapses because the banks are near to collapse. You can't get a mortgage, but you still got to move. You rent privately. That blue star's at a quarter. So a quarter of all children in England, in households, are in a family that's renting from a landlord who can evict them with 2 months' notice. In London, the average length of stay in private renting for children is less than 3 years. If you have to move and you can't stay in school catchment, you lose all your friends. Every 2 and a bit years, you lose all your friends. And it's that new. That's part of the kind of current crisis that's occurring. How do things get better? This again is inequality. It's very high. I'm showing you Germany and Japan. The only fast way things get better is when something truly disastrous happens, which is losing a war. When Germany and Japan lost the war, they actually became very equal countries. And we can go on about it if anybody's interested later, but there isn't generally a quick way to immediate greater equality other than something like that occurring. The slow way, this is Switzerland and the Netherlands, and this is a take of their 1%. People often tell you inequality is falling everywhere, inequality is rising everywhere. It's a lie. Other countries managed to get it down. The majority of countries in the OECD had falling inequality last year, falling inequality the year before. It is generally falling. Not in the UK, not in the USA. The UK may be at the peak. And we're weird. We are the most unequal country in Europe. We're the Texas of the continent. We're the strange, brash, arrogant people. Just think Boris Johnson. You've got to think. Okay, don't. If you want to know, it's not our fault. Somebody had to be the most unequal country of Europe. You know, kind of like we took the hit. be much nicer to be Finland. Might be a bit cold, you know, but if you think about how brash and annoying some Americans can be, you know, saying stupid things about how wonderful their health service is without realising they have the worst outcomes on the planet, right? And not caring about climate change and all the rest you get for Americans. We are the equivalent of the Americans of Europe. And what's really interesting about Brexit is that the countries on the mainland are currently playing a game. Not a game, they're trying to be kind. So, and the game is this. Don't be the first country that says, look, you haven't got anything worth bargaining with. There aren't any fish left. And we don't like your banks. That's what's going on in Brussels right now. And because they're decent and they don't want to hurt us, then nobody's saying it outright. But, and the reason I mentioned fish is only one country before us left the European Community, and that country is Greenland. Because Greenland had 56,000 people, they took a long time over it. They took 3 years to get it right. And because they had fish, the European Community took Greenland seriously, and they came up with a deal. And they're not in the European Community anymore, although because they can get Danish citizenship, they can actually travel freely and go use it because they get all the benefits. But we get some of the fish. The difference with the current negotiations is the lack of fish. And I've got the whole separate. And you may think, you may go, well, what about our wonderful pharmaceutical industry, and what about our brilliant car industry? Or, you know, we're not in a great place. And it's going to be a bit like the Suez Crisis, just much, much, much worse. And the danger is that the anger levels are going to be very high. When a generation who voted to leave to make Britain great again are told, actually, we didn't know how crap we were. If we hadn't done this, we could have happily carried on for a bit longer without quite realising how little of value we're doing. As it is, this thing is suddenly giving us this massive slap in the face of, they don't need us. And you put a yoghurt pot on that border in Ireland and you're in trouble, because that matters far more. And we didn't even know, because we're not very quick, that we signed an agreement that meant there is no border. You know, we didn't even realise it. They know that. People in Ireland know what the Good Friday Agreement was all about. Running out of time. Very few slides left. This is the standardised mortality rate in Britain. It goes down almost all the time until we get this kind of heart attack now, which is the rising deaths that we're getting. Death rise began in 2012, kind of tiny lag from the 2010 government coming in. The government said it's flu, especially influenza, really bad. Happened again in 2013, it was flu. 2014, they said it's flu. Flu normally only comes every 20 years. You know, and you can measure it, and you can even actually test the virus and find it's there. They weren't doing that. 2015, 50,000 deaths, huge numbers of deaths, biggest rise in deaths in 2015. Where are we here? Right, absolutely enormous rise in deaths. Why were you not told about it? You were told about it. The ONS press release came out on the day it was supposed to come out. On the 23rd of June, ONS released the news that 50,000 more people than expected had died. And it didn't make a single headline because we just discovered we voted to leave the European Community on the same day. Right? That wasn't a conspiracy, complete cock-up. Anyway, it reverts a bit down, knocks us down, and then goes up again. And the great news, if you want some good news, try and end on good news, the really good news is the government no longer says it's flu. That's a major achievement. It's taken 5 years of campaigning to get them to stop saying it's flu. Almost to the point of literally saying, you will be personally culpable for the deaths and the lawsuit if you keep on saying it's flu. If it's flu, it's a special kind of flu that doesn't go to other countries nearby. You know, kind of. Anyway. Last graph. Here we are. This says 35%, as you can't see. This is basically our tax rate as a country and the amount we spend on public services. These are other European countries. Told you we're odd. Labour increased the spending a bit in the early 2000s. Unfortunately, that was to pay for a war, but never mind. This rise here is bailing out the banks. This is where we are heading for. That's universal credit, you know, and so on. That's sitting around about 36%. Places like France and Finland, spending over 50%. The Labour Manifesto of June 2017 is there. Right, it moves us from there to there. That's what our entire argument is about. But it is a big argument for us. But it's about increasing public spending by between 1 and 2% more of GDP. And this is seen or depicted as completely unaffordable, irresponsible spending and socialism. Macron, if you worry about Macron in France, France is this little one here. Macron wants to move that down to there, which is a big deal in France. There'll be lots of strikes. The French know how to do that. I'm just trying to show you there's this whole world of possibilities that we can see by looking at other countries in Europe. Two more slides. These are the pictures in this Peak Inequality book. Yeah, these were protesters at the Lord Mayor's banquet, I think in 2011, in London. Where Cameron, you know, the Prime Minister always gives a speech at the Lord Mayor's banquet. And Cameron, the best lines from his speech in 2011 are, we are now in a position to tell the European community what it needs to do to come up to our standards. Something like that. I'm not quite got it right, but it's absolutely... You know, if you want to kind of have an idea of where we go wrong. Mm. And there's the last picture. That's the end of my slides. But if you think back to when you first saw that tower block, which if you don't go into London regularly on the coach, you went to see before, the reason you saw the tower block and the tower block story is depicted in the way it wasn't entirely because of the fire. If that had happened in the 80s, when there was a New Cross massacre in the 80s, if it had happened in different times, it would have been a tragic fire. The reason why that became such an event is because it happened within a week of the biggest landslide change, not victory, but biggest swing in the vote in Britain that has ever happened. Not just in peacetime, but also in wartime. In the run-up to June 2017, more people changed their minds faster than ever before at any poll we've ever measured in this country. Theresa May was completely correct to call an election. Never in the history of elections had somebody from that position not won. She had to be persuaded by her officials to do so. But it was a completely sensible thing to do, given all the evidence that there was. And then this utterly incredible thing happened in May and June. And the polls were all over the place, and you'll be glad to know I don't have the graph to show you the graph of this, because I've shown you too many. But when you look at it and smooth them out, and look at the speed of change and sentiment, people changed their minds in just 8 or 9 weeks. People decided, above all else, to bother to vote. That was a big one. People who just had given up voting were convinced that they should just bother and try and vote. Other people, young people, were convinced to vote for the first time rather than put it off for 3 or 4 elections, which is normal. And other people switched their vote from voting Liberal to voting Labour, from voting Green to voting Labour. Okay, would have helped if it gone the other way a little bit. The Tory vote rose because UKIP fell. It's telling me to shut up, it's quite good. But it was, and in terms of swing, just to give you a sense of where we are, Blair in 97 got a swing that wasn't bad. But that really wasn't for Blair. That was at the end of 18 years of Conservative rule. Right, it wasn't Blair that won it. Blair had a negative swing at the next election. Blair had an even bigger negative swing at the election afterwards, away from him. Gordon Brown, bless him, he'd waited all those years to finally get a go. Gordon Brown got an even bigger negative swing than Blair's biggest negative swing in the election because of the economic crisis and lost. Ed Miliband got a plus 1.4% swing, which in the context of how badly Blair and Brown had done, and that more and more people not liking them, was really good. You'd have had to have another 10 general elections before you'd actually won. This is Ed Miliband, isn't it?
No, it's his brother, David.
It's his brother. David can't come back over the water now. That was his plan, to come back triumphantly. I mean, honestly, working for International Rescue. You remember the cartoon?
Yeah.
And then the punchline of it, of course. In those 8 or 9 weeks, a party that had lost all sense of responsibility, which has been taken over by a load of mavericks, which didn't know what it was doing, got a bigger swing, faster swing than actually 1945, because the 1945 swing occurred over 10 years and the World War since 35. And suddenly you don't know what's possible anymore. Suddenly you can't say what the extent of possibilities of the next election are, because the impossible happened, and the impossible happened last year. And you imagine that with actually a little bit of unity in the Labour Party?
You know, yeah.
You know, you never know, just a tiny bit of it. Suddenly they're telling you, phone, this is Blair, isn't it? Stop saying this. So don't say it. Corbyn's still mad, get rid of him. That's the liability, he's an anti-Semite, don't you know it? Whatever. Anyway, I'll get off my hobby horse. I've talked for 10 minutes longer than I said I would do. Please think of a question. And please, particularly where you don't agree with me. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Danny. That contained a vast amount of data and all sorts of ideas to stimulate us. I've asked Danny, yes, he's put up the Weymouth and Portland map, because I think we all instantly recognise what that means to us in this area. And I know that we have friends here, colleagues from various parts of the most deprived areas, probably in the south of England, and we can see Underhill here.
Which
Fortune's Well, to be precise. Yeah, we can see Littlemore, and of course we can see Melcombe, as well as the. I mean, of course, this is Preston, isn't it? Unless I'm mistaken, up here. So, I think everything that Danny's been talking about in the national context is meaningful to us. But what we see is something, perhaps not unique in the country, but something which is really quite special, is that the outcome of 30 years of neoliberalism, combined with a specific history of the deindustrialisation of South Dorset, has produced this surge towards inequality and the crisis of poverty, wages and well-being that we're acutely aware of, and which has brought us together to discuss these issues today. So I'll stop there. I know there are lots of questions, but I do want to make sure that in this session that we do get some contributions around, particularly around the question of health, and I know that Debbie and Giovanna will have something to say about that. And then later, as our last session today, we'll be talking in particular about housing. But if we could see people who'd like to contribute now. Just a second, Richard. I think I saw just a couple of hands at the back earlier. No, I'm mistaken. Okay, let's go straight to Richard then.
Thank you for a very entertaining presentation, Danny. Brexit, it looks as if we could have a very bad deal, as you say. I'm a Remainer, obviously, and it looks as if a no deal could be disastrous, especially for the less well off in our society. How do you think a bad deal on Brexit will affect local wages? Because that's what.
Should we take two or three
about.
Together?
Okay, well, two at a time, because my memory can't do.
Yeah, sure, two at a time. Yes, Steve.
Your graph of inequality. As I understand what happened in the 1920s, amazingly, America voted for wealth taxes. They also brought in 80% income taxes, because America thought we're too unequal, and that's not America. America's an equal society. So a lot of countries voted in both wealth taxes and high top rates of tax. Do you think we could get back to that climate? Is that what? That's what we've lost through neoliberalism. People don't believe in wealth taxes, and they might come to believe in wealth taxes again. Or is that not possible?
Okay. I'll do that one first and then yours. It's particularly after Hoover had been in, so it was in the 30s, that Americans changed their attitudes. A lot of European countries have wealth taxes. These are, you know, an annual tax on the value of your house. Ireland has one which rises, if it's worth, I think, €1 million, to 0.1%. They're higher in Germany, and house prices are stable as a result. We, apart from inheritance tax, which only applies to people who are not rich enough to work out how to dodge it, Hardly anybody pays inheritance tax, by the way. In the whole of Hull, nobody is rich enough to pay it. It has zero. Even in Kensington, just 12% of people, partly because they now have to dodge it. Right. But anyway, we don't have. The countries which are more equal, which have decent state education because they pay for it, decent health care because they pay for it, they have kept high tax rates for the last 40 years. High tax rates don't raise much money. What high tax rates do is they stop people being greedy by demanding more money. And when you don't have people saying, I'm not going to carry on working in this business unless you pay me more, well, you're already being paid 150,000 and they're asking for another 50. In a country with a high tax rate at top taxes, you don't ask for more because it's pointless, you're only going to get 10 only. And that's the trick of high taxes, is it makes your country much more equal because the greedy are less greedy. The Tories don't get this. They keep on saying it won't raise much money. That's the point. You don't want it to raise much money because you don't want lots of people with too much money that they don't need. Hard Brexit. We are looking at redundancies, big rise in unemployment, falls down to the minimum wage. But if they're already at the minimum, I don't know what the figures are. Somerset, a quarter of the population are on the minimum wage. So they can't have their incomes dropped unless you're willing to break the minimum wage, which requires a change in the law. The people who will actually lose most with a hard Brexit, which I don't want, are actually they're better off than the rich. But they can lose that because this house price falls that have already begun will accelerate. Because you'll know with a hard Brexit that you're going to have a government coming in to sort everything out, which will require taxing the wealth of property. So a bit like how war brings people together afterwards, a hard Brexit will actually end up with a much more equal country, just a country equal in kind of misery, with a rising death rate, with having to queue for food. You know, unless we were... I have a stupid kind of plan for a hard Brexit, which says that people like me should eat slightly less than thinner people, you know, and you know, given a year and a bit of rationing. Ration cards? This may sound silly, but there's a load more documents that I haven't begun to read, released 2 days ago. But I read the 25 documents released a couple of months ago, and you just don't spot the detail. There's one, none of you are in charge of a civic nuclear facility, okay? But I am partly in charge of a civic nuclear facility because my university have got some. And the document for the civil nuclear facility says, at the end of it, the government will take over any funding you have from the European Community for the whole of 2019. Then, we suggest you seek professional advice. Now, presumably that is, how do you do the redundancy bill, and what kind of concrete do you order in to pour over your civic nuclear facility? It's amazing, we're learning so much about ourselves. If you've got, I won't say in this kind of audience who's got a small business, there's nothing wrong with having a small business, but if you've got a small business, you know if you've got a small business, because you'll have received a 150-page document last week or the week before from HMM Treasury, telling you, welcome to the world of exporters, you're suddenly an exporter, and here's all the work you've got to do, because you thought you were just trading inside Europe, but now you've got to work out all of this you don't know how to do, and your small business could be in trouble. Let's go to the other extreme. So the other extreme is that May, and she takes it to the wire, on the 29th of March, 10 o'clock at night, she sends a telegram to Brussels, revoking Article 50. She can do that on her own. She doesn't have to ask anybody. It's entirely up to her. She revokes Article 50. She does a hell of a speech. I can do you the speech. I'm a patriot, I've tried everything else, I haven't slept for the last 2 years, you know, I'm dying of this. Do with me what you like, it's for the good of my country. We'll be in disarray the next day. Can you imagine what the papers will be saying? I mean, if they're willing to call judges, then enemies of the people. The fallout, and for me that's the best option. Yeah. The people's vote is kind of like a kind of long and painful version of that, with the chance of Leave winning again. You know, I'm not saying against it, but honestly, the thing is, what you should get ready for is whatever happens, it's all bad. And it's not only all bad, it's all going to happen very, very quickly. But it's not as bad as the war. But that's the that's the last time we've had anything like this, isn't it? We haven't had anything. We set this up for ourselves. In that situation, this is a... You shouldn't say Brexit anymore, you should say Tory Brexit. Right? It's their Brexit. Yeah. They wanted it. They arranged a referendum. Their party mainly went for it. Right? It's a Tory Brexit. And out of a Tory Brexit... Well, Sue is, okay, 10 times less bad than Brexit. Just a bit kind of shameful, embarrassing, if you can remember it. We realise we're no longer powerful. A few years after Sue is, we got the swing in the 60s. Things got better. It's not impossible to imagine a country where all the nasty things we commonly take for granted, that the people who are better than us should be ruling us, all that kind of rubbish that most Europeans... Yeah, it's not impossible to imagine a future after whatever happens between now and the 29th of March, which actually is better for our children and grandchildren. It's just that now is the time we're going to have to be bothered. You can kind of be bothered for the next 2 years, knock on doors and do stuff. You retire for the rest of your life, have a holiday, don't bother. I'm being a bit facetious, but there are particular times of history where things could go one way or the other, and now really looks like one of them. I promise any other answers will be short.
Okay, John.
Thanks very much. I'll bring it back to the health topic as you suggested. Two points to make. One is about the mortality and the second is about Brexit and how they both impact on health. I'm a GP and a local councillor. I work just above the H on the in one of the red bits.
Yeah.
So the mortality, I've seen your figures in the BMJ over the last couple of years, 30,000 excess, then 100,000 excess.
Yes.
And I've thought, how are those happening? Because for us, we're about a 1/100 of the population of England, so I'm thinking some of the people I'm certifying dead are your statistics, but I still put bronchopneumonia as the cause, because that's the final, so that doesn't show on the national statistics. But I know why they die, it's because they can't get home help anymore. Mm-hmm. And they used to have Meals on Wheels, and they don't get it, and their bus service is gone. So I can see the mechanism, and that's I can see it's real. It only really shows up on your big statistics.
Yes.
I don't see it on my death certificates, but it's absolutely happening. So that's the first point.
Yeah.
Second bit is a little linking the health to Brexit. Health service has never trained enough of its own staff. We are too stingy. We're a rich country. There's plenty of people would like to learn medicine and nursing, but we've always relied on bringing people from abroad until we've become really nasty. So my practice, we've got 3 doctors from abroad, 2 from the rest of the world, 1 from Europe. They've already here. If it was now, they wouldn't be getting here because it's a hostile environment.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it on the red on the bottom there. Yeah. The practice down there is hanging on by its fingernails.
Yeah.
There are not enough doctors. They can't get recruit nurses, and they closed the ward. And the red above the M of Weymouth is
Abbotsbury.
Where we're in now. Mm. Their practice is just closed. They cannot recruit.
Yeah.
And part of that, we would have in the past gone to Europe, gone to the Commonwealth. Mm. But because of this hostile, nasty environment we put out, we don't want you here, we cannot recruit. And it's an absolute crisis.
Right. Great. Yeah. Let me do that one, because that's very short.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And the other thing is Alzheimer's and dementia. And the thing is, if you get Alzheimer's and dementia, you'll now die 3 years earlier than you would have died in 2007, 2008. Nowhere else in Europe has this going on. A third of our midwives in Oxford and London are EU, not UK citizen. And the deaths are happening around the time of birth when you need the midwives there. The other thing that's going on is you've got a government who doesn't believe in the health service. Mm.
Yeah.
And the way you get rid of something is you make it so bad that people are happier. Yeah.
Mm.
And they don't believe in it because it shows you can do a model of behaving humanly in a different way that works. And if it's true, it means their entire belief system is wrong. And that's why they hate it. I think that's true. I worry about saying this because it's possible that they're so stupid they don't know what they're doing. And it's hard, actually, with the current health secretary, Matt Hancock, to actually know. Matt might just be too stupid. But what's a little lad Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt wasn't that stupid. Jeremy Hunt knew exactly what he was doing. So you've got this really nasty mix of actually wanting to run down the health service with things going on that will run it down. I go to the dentist in County Centre in Oxford, it's where I went when I was a child. They have about 20 dentists, it's brilliant. They serve a huge quarter of the city. My dentist has left because his wife used to work for the medicines agency and that's already gone to Amsterdam. Everything's moving. I asked them how many of the 20 dentists were British and they said, oh, we got one, Mr. Singh. Now Mr. Singh is going to have his work cut out if he's going to do the teeth of a quarter of Oxford City next year. I mean, but this is all solvable. We're going to go from being whatever it is, the sixth richest country to the seventh and eighth very, very fast. Yeah. That's already on the cards because the pound's dropped. But still the eighth richest country in the world. You know, we can sort it out within 2 or 3 years. We've got to think about 1945-46. And what we sorted out by 1948, right? It's entirely possible, but you have to let people know this is the scale of the thing that needs to be done, and this is the situation we're in. And by the way, we're not in this crap situation because, you know, because of the Labour Party. People are going to be told all kinds of lies.
Yeah.
Good. I think we'll just, if it's okay with people, we'll take two or three more. Yeah. We'll see how we're going, because we do have one more session specifically about housing. Just a quick point about our members of parliament, mm-hmm. You know, their intellectual capacity. We have someone called Richard Drax. People say, and they may be right, he's not the sharpest tool in the box. So there may be people who are a bit slow on the uptake, but we have Oliver Letwin. Ooh. And Oliver Letwin is actually quite a sharp operator. He was one of Margaret Thatcher's key advisors. And of course, he authored the book together with John Redwood that set out the whole scheme for the privatisation of the NHS in the way that you've described, Danny. Debbie, would you...
Really, just if you had a prescription, I'm kind of a big NHS campaigner here. If you had a kind of prescription for, you know, what we could do, or what if the will was there, could be done.
Yeah.
Just what would it be, really? I mean, I don't know if there's anything we can do to try and halt. And when we've taken a court case to try and stop the closure of the A&E and the maternity and the beds, we've done all. We're going through the local authority, which is a thankless task because it's nearly all Tory controlled down here, trying to get held scrutiny to reject plans, although we know if they go back to the Secretary of State, they just sit on them largely. It's very rarely that anything good comes back. Mm. But we fight every way we can. But I don't know if there's anything more we could do, or, you know, what would a government do that wanted to turn it around?
Lynn.
Yeah. I think what Danny said about, you know, specific times in history is actually very important. And yeah, a lot of people who've been involved in health stuff, obviously Debbie and Giovanna, are very central. But I think sometimes you, first of all, even though what the court case lost, I still think it was
all sick and leave to
right. Right. You could call it, I think it's a very important delaying tactic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm a health worker. The way I look at it is, you know, it's been one attack after another. But they still, I mean, for example, another statistic that came out that horrified me, in Birmingham, where Harry was born, 10 years ago, the caseload of a health visitor was 250 families. Now it's 500 families. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, what happens in that situation is health visitors leave because actually, if they don't, they'll actually crack up. You can't service 500 mm-hmm. families. And then when you don't service one, where, you know, baby P dies, you are held personally responsible. No one says you had 500 cases, and, you know, you're actually blamed. One of the really interesting things happened recently was when Richard Drax called the meeting in Portland about the closure of the community hospital. Now, you know, for me, that was very telling because, you know, we'd been up in the ante over the Portland closure. It had some fantastic protests at the scrutiny committee where people raised really good points. We had demonstrations outside, and the people in that meeting looked bloody uncomfortable. Very, very, very uncomfortable indeed, because they could not defend what they were doing. Richard Drax starts to feel under pressure, and he calls a public meeting. That's how stupid he is. He calls a public meeting. First in Weymouth, but under pressure, he moves it to Portland because the transport's so rubbish that people say he wants it in Portland.
Yeah.
200 people come. Did Richard Drax think 200 people would come in Portland? If he thought that, he wouldn't have called it. So I think we're in this very critical situation where it can, you know, for people who've campaigned for a long time, it could seem so tiring, but it's actually still winnable. It's still winnable. Things are in the balance. They want to get these transformation plans through, which are essentially privatisation of the NHS everywhere. They haven't succeeded in doing it. They keep putting the goalposts a bit further. It's very, very tiring and wearing, but I think it's time for us always to keep upping the ante. And, you know, in lots of ways, whether it's, you know, Giovanna probably got the date of the next health scrutiny committee.
Wednesday.
So they hate it. They absolutely hate it when we turn up. They hate it when people have done lots of research and say, you know, the ambulance times, if you close Pool A&E, will mean that X number of people die. You can't do that unless you want to kill these people.
Yeah.
You know, you have to keep doing this. Waypoor's part of that. All these other campaigns are part of that. I think it's very, very important to keep the pressure on in every single way possible. Quite often, you don't realise how close you are to tipping the balance. I mean, one of the things about the Stop the War movement, which I was very involved in Birmingham, was, you know, we didn't stop the war. But actually, you know, in 30 years' time, when the documents come out, we came very, very close. Very, very close indeed. We have to work on all the time that what the pressure we have to put is in every single way. You know, and, you know, maybe we need, you know, people have so much information about these health things. Maybe we need more of this on, you know, on the websites for people to access. But I think we need to be on the streets, carrying on, even if people are tired. I think if necessary, we need to do things. You know, Giovanna and people have just spotted, their real plan is to sell off the community hospital.
Yeah.
It's absolutely obvious. You know, they think we're stupid. We know exactly what they're up to. We should be talking to people in the community about that hospital, and we should be looking, if necessary, at occupying it, even if it's a symbolic occupation.
Yeah, let's do it. Come on.
We have to say, this is our hospital. Who do you think you are selling this off?
Yeah.
It's not yours to sell. And I think, you know, if people go in and do something like that and occupy, all the people who don't really realise what's even happening to the Portland Community Hospital start thinking, what's happening at Portland Community Hospital? People went and occupied it. Mm-hmm. What are they doing? Yeah. Why did they do that? You know, great front page for the Echo, keep it occupied. I think you've got to think of those things. They don't have to involve millions of people. The more they involve, the better. But, you know, we have to look at carrying on. Every single way we fight is relevant. You know, legally, direct action, trade unionisation, it's all important. So I think we need to really, really keep strong, because I think Danny's right. This is an absolutely crucial point.
But also, I can't remember, so I won't do it. Don't worry about the temporary setback, because doesn't matter what they put through, you have to. It's a change in national government which will be the big thing that changes things. A national government can put through any legislation it likes, and in the event of a national economic emergency, which we're heading for, the idea that somebody thinks that they own the property of something they've bought goes. So what I'm involved in tomorrow is drafting the draft legislation for what you do about the student debt since 2012, until the day before the Labour election. For the moment Labour or Labour SNP coalition are elected, there are no more student fees and loans for tuition fee. That's the right, which is great. But what happens if you're if you've gone to university the day before? Right, do you still own 60 or 70 thousand?
Yes.
So what you obviously do, you have a policy which says if you went in 2012, you are the same as somebody went in 2011, which is a maximum cap of 12,000 or 4,000 per year, not nine. And it goes right down to zero if you go to university the day before Labour win, which is a great incentive to vote Labour, not just for half the population who go to university, but also their parents and their grandparents, and maybe even their mates. And you just declare that as a policy now, and you say that any private company stupid enough to purchase the loan is taking a risk, and that's why they're getting interest, and part of that risk is they lose everything if Labour's elected. And you just say it, and you say we're in a national economic emergency. The opposition are currently planning a major policy every day for 100 days on homelessness, on housing, on health, on everything. New policy every day, 5 days a week. The Daily Mail will be talking about the thing from 3 days ago as you keep on going. And you need to remember that that is potentially coming. The thing I think to always think about is, you know, when Labour did very well in 97, a whole load of people who didn't expect to get elected got elected. The same happened in 45, Harold Wilson never thought he'd become a Labour MP. It's worth looking at the seats you think that Labour could never win down here, and just being a bit careful that whoever the candidate is actually prepared to be an MP. And I only say that because it happened in 97 and it happened in 45. You know, sorry for PCC sitting in the room going, oh, there's no chance of winning here. But, you know, that needs working for as well. Because you don't want to end up with 100, you know. If it's the worst this disaster is, the better Labour are going to do. And people will find themselves in the House of Commons. And then they're going to have to work 60 hours a week.
I think probably we should start, we should just take a couple more and then conclude this session. We do have some very other very important things to talk about. So I'm just looking around the room. Would that be all right, by the way? Would that be okay if we don't, how many, can I just see hands of people who'd like to speak? 1, 2, 3, 4. Could I ask you, you know, in the usual way, to if you could be fairly brief, so that then Danny can respond, and then we will move quickly towards a concluding session on housing.
So, I'd like to ask if I could raise the blind and let the fresh air in.
Sure. It was making rather a lot of noise. We had to such a windy day, but Jason.
Okay. Jason West from Way Forward, a local sort of social activist group. Just a quick question. When I woke up on the morning after Brexit, my Danish partner was in tears. And between us, I'm an educator, you're an educator, and she is to some respects. We both felt it was a failure of education, primarily. How important and how much potentially of a problem is class in education? And taking that further, how much of a problem potentially is class in Oxbridge?
Yeah. Good question. Claudia.
I'm Claudia, I'm a Labour Party activist. I live in Dorchester, but I work in Weymouth. And I know that Weymouth and Portland had a high percentage that voted Leave,
60%? Yeah, 60%.
It was a high percentage. As somebody who campaigns locally, knocks on doors and speaks to people, you know, I wonder how we take our message. One of the, about Brexit, one of the ideas I've read about recently is that if Labour gets in, we rescind Article 15 and propose a national consultation about the relationship that we want as a country with Europe. I wonder what you think of that idea, and also I'm very grateful to you for mentioning the racist aspect that has come about because of Brexit. I'm fighting against Brexit because I see it as a racist movement, and it coming from a mixed family where My husband is French. We've personally experienced it since Brexit.
Thank you.
So thanks for bringing that up.
Now, could I just take two more quick ones, Danny, if that's all right? And I'll just say this very, very quickly, there are members of various political parties in the room, so, you know, you may want to make a contribution on your time to vote account. Mike?
Yeah, just I'm Mike from the Dorset Equality Group and affiliated nationally with the Equality Trust. My point actually would have been to Ava, actually. It sort of dovetails nicely with Danny. It's about health and social care. And about a year ago, the Economic and Social Research Council did their annual festival. And one of the talks in Bournemouth was, quite timely, in fact, to Brexit on health and social care. And there's actually a really good project that's been run in the Southwest, lots of data on impact in the first year after Brexit referendum. And that's something that, I don't know, incorporated into other research. Something's already flagged up. There's obviously a very evidence-based issue there about health and care staff being no longer welcome in a country they've often lived for decades. Yeah. And that's people have left. Even people from Nepal and Canada have left or gone back to Australia. And that's, you know, if you aren't even in the Red Line and the Windrush generation, of course.
Do you want to announce this?
Time limit. Yeah,
do you want to announce this?
Yeah, when you're ready.
But can you just announce it now? Do you think it's a good time? Could you do it? Or do you want to do it later at the end
of
the meeting?
I don't mind, whenever you want, really.
I'll do it
twice. Three times.
Go on.
Yeah, just the demo that Lynn mentioned, I might have put the date up there, but this Wednesday, 17th of October, we are demonstrating outside County Hall in Dorchester at 1:30, because we're then going into a meeting at 2:00 where a bunch of Tory councillors who have the power will probably not vote the way that we want. And, you know, what has happened, one of our great strengths is getting numbers at those meetings. It does make a difference. The press love it. They get our message out. And, you know, we've delayed things, haven't we, locally, because of that. And I can't, you know, if you're worried about all this stuff, you know, come and help us, because we're doing what we can. So I sound a bit desperate. So, just turn up, you know, even if you just come for half an hour, make a lot of noise outside, we would be really, really grateful. Do you want me to stick that up there or something?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you can help me promote it in any way, please do. The other thing is we've got a target county councillor in Weymouth that we want people to lobby. This is his email address. Mm-hmm. He sat at Weymouth and Portland Borough Council the other night. We got a motion passed because of our Labour councillors, saying that they would lobby the Health Scrutiny Committee and support what we want. Fantastic, thank you, councillors. This chap abstained because he sits on the committee that has the power to make the decision. He represents Broadway, he lives in Weston, and we just want people to email him, and, you know, I can give email me and I'll tell you what to say, you know. So, can I stick those up there? Have we got any tape?
You can write
You know, if you live in Weymouth, if you live in Broadway, let him know, you know, that you're not happy with what's going on. He's got the power, I tell you. There are 12 people who can decide at this meeting to do what we're asking for. 10 of them are Tories. Lib Dems are with us, and a couple of the Tories, the rest. Thank you.
What we're asking for, we're asking for the plans. All the clinical commissioning groups, NHS Dorset plans, to be referred to the Secretary of State for the independent review. We're basically saying they're not in the interests of the people of Dorset, and they're certainly not in the interests of the people who are Dorset County Council residents. Four of the five community hospitals that are going are in Dorset County Council area, and it's Dorset County Council residents in North Dorset and in Purbeck, who will lose access to A&E and maternity within safe guideline times. So where we live in Swanage, in acute stroke, maternity emergency and major trauma, we will never be able to get to A&E within safe times once Paul goes. So please come. It is very tedious meeting, but it might be a bit more exciting because we're putting them on the spot. The demo will be a bit more fun, but please come on Wednesday because it's probably the last time they'll vote. It's the third time they voted. They voted to refer, they were lobbied by the clinical commission group, they changed their minds. We got a full hearing for the judicial review, they thought they'd better look at it again. They put it on hold till after the judicial review. We didn't win the judicial review, although we are seeking leave to appeal. So they think they've got carte blanche now not to refer it. But we've been fighting with Purbeck District Council, we've lobbied for referral, Wayne from Portland have lobbied for referral, lots of little parishes have lobbied for referral. So we've put up a really big fight.
Okay.
And this is maybe the last thing I'll consider it. It's 2 o'clock on Wednesday, County Hall meeting, 1:30, the deadline.
Back to Giovanna.
I just want to say one thing. We're all affected by the maternity unit closure. Community beds are going. In August, 16 went from Portland, 22 went in Ferndown, and Wareham's going to lose 16 this month. Okay, and this is, there are more to follow. This is supposed to be supported by something called Care Closer to Home. District nurses locally have told us they are struggling, they can't cope. Now, you know, one day all of us might need the district nurses to come in. This is your health service, so please support us. What's going on is shocking, and there's loads more.
Okay.
I think we'll ask Danny to conclude.
Sorry, Danny.
Leslie, could you do it in 1 minute, possibly? Please.
I wanted to ask about the change of demographics. On Portland particularly, there's a huge amount of building going on. Most of it is second home. So although that map looks like that now, it's not going to stay like that.
Yeah.
It's going to be largely second home ownership.
Maybe we can take that up when Steve talks to us about the back home. So I've got to ask Danny to come back.
Okay, come back. But people only at the moment get one vote, luckily. Not one vote per home they own. They want that as well, by the way. Okay, I've got three questions to answer. Oxbridge and class. It's not Oxbridge, it's Oxford. Cambridge only produced Nick Clegg. and some Tory ministers in the 90s. It looks particularly bad now. When the country is very unequal, Oxford's very, very bad. It produces terrible politicians, which it did 100 years ago, which it does now. Theresa May's from my department. It's our first geographer, Prime Minister. Nobody gets that excited. They're all from Oxford. But in the 60s, Wilson was from Oxford, Attlee was from Oxford, I think Barbara Castle's from Oxford. They were all from Oxford again. They weren't quite as bad. The nice thing about the future is they won't be from Oxford, because the reason why Oxford has such control over politics is because other universities were much smaller in the past or didn't exist. Right, and that time is going over. Jeremy Corbyn and co, most of the shadow cabinet, didn't touch Oxford or Cambridge or necessarily even a university with a barge pole. But we're moving away from this position. What do you tell people on the doorstep? I knock on doorsteps. It's particularly hard in areas of Oxford that vote Liberal because they go, "Oh, Brexit, we're not voting Labour for you," which is very annoying. That's all going to end on the 29th of March. That kind of discussion. But what we've got to remember is that people were only given two choices. It was business as usual, carry on with nothing changing, or something else. And it was your first time in your life for many people, because in most constituencies your vote doesn't matter. First time in your life you offer people a vote that might actually matter, and you offer them a choice. And even, that's like Russian roulette, even a choice of, you know, it could kill you, but at least it's going to be different. And they went for that, because things have got so bad. So what you've got to tell people on doorstep is, we can give you something better than this. And the something better than this are decent schools that you'll want your children to go to, where you're not fighting for them to go to another school. You know, hospitals are the standard of the average in Europe. The number of doctors and nurses are the average of Europe. Housing quality, of just the average of Europe. We've got a long way to go to get to the average. Housing quality, soundproofing, insulation, room size. Maybe even, if you want to be really utopian, that quality of housing at the average European price that people pay for housing in Europe.
Yeah.
And you can carry on the kind of education service they have in Europe at the moment. This comes back to education. People in Britain don't know, just like the Americans don't know, how bad what we're getting is. Compared to elsewhere. But you've got to offer people something better than this. And the great thing is that you're not sitting in Scandinavia trying to say, how the hell do we do even better at these things? How do we get child poverty down from the lowest rate it's ever been in the history of the planet, even lower? Now that's hard. You're sitting in a country where a quarter of the children are poor, and it's not that hard to work out how to reduce that, you know, a bit. And the last question about the care. I think the really ironic thing, and this is why it's really worth doing what you're doing. See, not everybody's going to need a maternity hospital. I should say, you said everybody needs a maternity hospital. No, you know, it's women. Obviously, their male partners do want it as well. But everybody's going to, if you're lucky, going to need the care at the end. If you're unlucky, you get hit by a bus and you don't. But if, that's the majority of us are going to need the care at the end. Here's the real irony of this, that the bulk, the vast majority of these people who've died early, now 120,000 who've died early, the vast majority of them were elderly, late 70s, early 80s, dying a few years early. They were middle class, because it's mostly middle class people who get to those ages, working class people tend to die earlier. They were mostly in the south, because the south is, they're around here, and they mostly, as far as I can see, and we can't prove this, they voted Conservative in 1979. And they voted Conservative in 83. Do you remember Kinnock saying, was it 83 or 87? You know, don't be old, don't be poorly, don't be whatever. Mm. He was completely right, but he was talking about their future 30 years ahead. Mm. And now they're sitting there, and they might be okay today, but they have a minor stroke tomorrow, and they can't drive, and they can't feed themselves, and their successful children who went to university away, because that's what you do in England, mm-hmm. have now gone and they're working in another country. Yeah. And they're the ones. And what you've got to get through to people, and here's the problem with people being optimistic, is that people think it won't happen to me. Andrew Lansley thought he wouldn't get bowel cancer, right? But death is going to happen to us all. And if we're lucky, there'll be a couple of years of being ill at the end, and it won't be a sudden death this afternoon on the way back from, you know, to be careful crossing the road. Right? And you can tell people, this is going to happen to you. And the question then is, do you want the person inserting the catheter in you, or otherwise getting you in and out of bed, to actually want to be doing that job or not? Mm. And try to imagine what the last year or 2 years of your own personal, selfish-like life are going to be like if you don't make it better. So you don't have to ask people to be altruistic. You don't have to ask them to be selfish and nice to others. You just have to get them to think about the end of their own life and what kind of a country they would like to die in. And then it is obvious that you need something different just for yourself. It's not a great conversation to have on doorsteps. there are other ways of doing it. But get people to realise, you're not making this up. You know, it does. We're all affected by a health service. We're all affected by housing. All of us at some time, all our children and grandchildren are affected by schools and education. We're all affected by just a general sense of a society you're in. A happier, more equal society, if you just look around it and you can go and see what it's like, is a place where people feel safer, where crime is lower, but where people say hello to each other more. And if you want to know what a more unequal society is, what will actually happen if we let it get worse, because that's the other thing, is nobody's saying, well, what happens when they do close hospitals? Mm. It's easy, you just go over to Baltimore, Detroit. You can see what happens when you imprison 2 million people rather than just 80,000. Mm. You can see what happens when 1 in 13 black women are evicted every year in the worst streets. You can see what happens when your homelessness numbers are so high that there isn't enough space on the pavements to sleep. You've only got to go to the poorest parts of the United States of America. Right? So it's all there. The choice is there in front of us. And it's getting that over to people and realising that we muck things up terribly, right? It happens occasionally. You do make a terrible mess of it. But out of having mucked things up terribly, this is entirely possible because thankfully and very luckily we're a rich country, not a very poor country where we really would be stuffed. It's entirely possible within a relatively small number of years to get to a level of decency and then try to actually aim for something you might be proud of having. It's not making Britain great again, because it never was. It was the core of the world's biggest empire, it did terrible things. It's making Britain something it's never been, and thinking about itself carefully, and it's a long way to get there. Thank you very much for letting me.